I don't remember when Jay called, but he asked how it went last Wednesday night. I said, oh, okay, I guess. Maybe you should ask somebody else rather than the speaker how things went. And I asked Diane, I said, what do you think I should... What? Higher? Okay. I asked Diane what she thought I should speak about this week. And she said, well, you could continue on since you had more material. And that was tempting to be sure, but it was a pretty heavy subject last week talking about Satan's war. And this particular lesson actually dovetails with last week's. It may not seem like it on the surface, but in reality it does. If you read towards the tail end of Revelation, it's interesting after God wraps it up. He says, let the one who is righteous still practice righteousness, and let the one who is filthy still be filthy. So there's a tendency that even though God can lay out the entire picture for mankind, just like He did in the book of Revelation, most people are going to continue to do what they've always done. But there's always that certain small percentage that if they're given the right message, they'll change their mind, change their life, and change their entire eternity. So in light of Satan's war, what are you and I to do? Well, we're supposed to do what we've always done. Doesn't matter where you live, what age, whether the tree's green or the tree's dry, whether the world is receptive or the culture is antagonistic to the message, our job's always the same. To study the Word, to live it, to pray through it, and to share it. This evening we're going to take a look at My Brother's Keeper. My Brother's Keeper. We're all familiar with the story in Genesis chapter 4 when Cain killed his brother Abel. And then God sort of knocked on his door while he was doing his own thing. And his mind was guilty, you can be sure of that. God said, hey, where's your brother? Cain said, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Well, the entire Bible is devoted to answering that question. Am I my brother's keeper? Now, part of this material we shared, I think it was about a year and a half ago, when I had to substitute for Nick, did a three-week class on extreme discipline in the life of Jesus. So this is just part of what we shared in one of those lessons. But this is actually a message delivered in family camp when we were still in the Lucky camp outside of Livingston there. So this is a good number of years ago, probably 15, I'm guessing, because Brian was pretty small. But when I first became a Christian in Great Falls, Montana, when I was 18 years old, I was going to commercial college. And one of the things I did, I got a good job with the post office, a part-time job. Whopping $3-something an hour. It may not sound like much now, but that's pretty good money. I was clearing about $70 every 2 weeks working part-time. And that was pretty good money back then for a part-time job. One of the things I would do, I had to walk from the city housing where we were at down to the post office there in Great Falls. And it was probably about a good 3-4 miles. So it was a good 20-25 minute walk. And what I would do is I would take my Bible along with me and I would read as I was walking. Sort of like reading while you're riding horseback. You know, the ride's a little bit bumpy. But one of the passages I happened to be reading one day was right out of Ezekiel chapter 3. There's a very similar passage in Ezekiel chapter 33. But in Ezekiel chapter 3, I want you to turn there, beginning with verse 16. Ezekiel 3:16. This is part of what I was reading, and it mentally stopped me in my tracks. Ezekiel chapter 3, beginning with verse 16. At the end of 7 days, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, I have appointed you a watchman to the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, warn them from me. When I say to the wicked, you will surely die, and you do not warn him or speak out to warn the wicked man from his wicked way that he may live, that wicked man shall surely die in his iniquity. But his blood I will require at your hand. Yet if you have warned the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness or from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered yourself. Again, when a righteous man turns away from his righteousness and commits iniquity, and I place an obstacle before him, he will die. Since you have not warned him, he shall die in his sin, and his righteous deeds which he has done will not be remembered, but his blood I will require at your hand. However, if you warn the righteous man that the righteous man should not sin, and he does not sin, he shall surely live because he took warning, and you have delivered yourself. Now, it's always been clear to me as a Christian, even before I became a Christian, I knew that to be a Christian meant to proclaim the Word of God to everyone, everywhere. I understood that from day one, and even before I actually became a Christian. Now, we need to understand the importance of evangelism in the mind of God. And there are three words that command our attention when it comes to evangelism. The first word is intensity. Second word is reality. And the third word is responsibility. So let's consider for a moment intensity. When you consider the life of Jesus, it's rather obvious that that was his purpose in coming. Jesus said, I came to seek and save that which was lost. In John chapter 12, the last day, probably sometime in the afternoon, before the Last Supper, the very last day before Jesus would be betrayed in the middle of the night, and then the next day be crucified, Jesus said, I'm very troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. He says, but for this purpose I have come to this hour. See, it was Jesus' purpose to seek and save the lost. And that required his coming in the flesh, humbling himself, just to live in a human body, to divest himself of his glory, and to preach and teach and live a perfect life, and then eventually to go and die on the cross, raised victoriously from the grave, resurrect, and then reign as our great prophet and priest and king on his throne until he comes again to take us home. But he said, that was my purpose, to seek and to save the lost. It was also his food. In John chapter 4, we're all familiar with the story, the woman at the well. Jesus is heading up north. He actually spent most of his ministry up north in Galilee. And so it's late in the day, and he sits down by the well in Sychar of Samaria. He sends the disciples into town to get some food at the local Burger King or McDonald's. I don't think it was quite that convenient, but they had to go into town to get some food. The woman at the well comes out. Jesus has his conversation with her. She goes hightailing it back in town to tell the people, is this guy a prophet? Is this guy the Messiah? In the meantime, the disciples come back with some food. They're trying to give Jesus some food and say, hey, Master, eat. And he says, I have food that you don't know about. They're saying to themselves, somebody bring him food? And Jesus said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me. See, evangelism was Jesus' food. Now, something interesting about food, two things. Number one, you need food. If you don't have it, it won't take you very long, 40 days at the most. Some of us probably less than that. And you're gone, period. So you need food. But there's another interesting thing. God has designed our mouth to have taste buds so that we like food. Now, I've only known one person, a guy that I knew for just a little while, that had no taste buds. I don't remember due to sickness or he's born that way. So long ago, I don't remember. But he couldn't taste, so he could care less what vegetables you gave him, or whether or the dessert, or what meat. He couldn't taste it. So in his case, he only ate according to the need of his stomach. But for the rest of us, that's probably everybody in this room, we all need food, and we all like food. Well, what was Jesus' need and what was his like? Evangelism. Evangelism. And it was also the reason that he had to be crucified. I want you to turn to Luke chapter 23. This is very familiar to all of us. This is about the so-called good thief on the cross. Luke chapter 23, we're going to pick up in verse 32. So you can just transpose that. Luke 23, verse 32. Two others also who were criminals were being led away to be put to death with him. When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him and the criminals, one on the right, the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. And the people stood by looking on, and even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if this is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." Now there was also an inscription above him, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who were hanging there was hurling abuse at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other answered and rebuked him, saying, "Do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? For we indeed are suffering justly, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And he was saying, "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." Now if you read the parallel accounts in Matthew and Mark, you'll find out that initially both thieves were hurling abuse at Jesus. See, that's the nature of the criminal mindset. Usually vulgarity is a common part of their everyday speech. And so when their back's against the wall, they're just going to rail at everybody. And that's what the two guys were doing. But somehow the one thief was paying attention. And he changed his mind at the last moment before he died. The thing I want to focus on for just a moment is the pain that Jesus had to endure on the cross. Notice Jesus' response. He said, "Today you shall be with me in paradise." Jesus, in the midst of his own agony, was so focused on personal evangelism that he could save this thief at the last moment. The pain's interesting. I never experienced the pain of childbirth. Never going to happen. Schwarzenegger was in a movie about a guy being pregnant, but no guy's ever been pregnant, so none of us have ever experienced that pain of childbirth. In Diane's case, she always sort of rolls her eyeballs a little bit. She was sort of lucky. She spent less time in labor with three kids than the average woman does with the first. Probably about 5 hours of labor altogether, and I'm not sure it was that much if you add it all up. But I have an idea what that pain could possibly be like, because I have what's called a lactose intolerance. There's, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 million people in the U.S. alone that have lactose intolerance, and it's not an allergy. It's just simply an intolerance. In other words, the body doesn't break down the milk sugar or the lactose like it should. And as a result, it gathers in the system and people have various symptoms. Sometimes people will bloat. Most people will have cramps. And some people will pass gas, have diarrhea. In my case, first time it happened in high school, it was right before basketball practice. Second time was in fighting a fire. And third time, I was in Missouri, and however many times after that, I don't remember. But I used to work for Schreiber Cheese, and whenever I came home from work, I used to douse about 2 milkshakes a night. Now, you add about half a dozen or so milkshakes. About every 2 weeks, I was having an attack in the middle of the night. I thought I was going to die. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I went to the doctor and did all the tests and berry enema and the whole nine yards, all that fun stuff. But what would happen to me is the pain would become so intense, it was just cramping in my stomach. And it was like a wave of pain. It would start out as cramping, and I knew from experience what was coming. And then it would subside for just a little bit. I'd be on the toilet. I had diarrhea. I mean, I've fallen in tubs of water, things like that. I remember one time in the shower, I came into the shower at college, and we had sinks on one side and the showers, half a dozen, and then stalls on the other side. I went into the stall. One guy came in the shower. But the pain would just well up in wave of pain, and at some point, the pain would become so intense I literally passed out. My body couldn't handle the pain. The only thing it could do in self-defense was pass out. That's how intense the cramping was in my stomach. But like during that shower, I remember the guy coming in for the shower. I remember the shower water turning on. Next thing you know, I was out like a light. When I woke up, he was gone. The lights were off in the bathroom. I was out at least 5 minutes. Wake up in a cold sweat. White as a sheet. It's sort of like when you get that certain feeling in the pit of your stomach, you wake up in the middle of the night and you know what's coming and you try and make it to the toilet, or at least you hope a garbage is close by, and you know what's coming up through your gastric system and through your nose and through your throat, and such a sick feeling in your stomach, but there's nothing you can do. You just got to throw up. Well, this is worse than throwing up, believe me. Even just describing it, you almost, you know how it is. I haven't had to do that for a couple of years, but what's that, Tom? Okay, Tom. But the interesting thing about that kind of pain is it's incapacitating. In other words, you're just overwhelmed by the pain. There's nothing else you can do or think about or concentrate on. I mean, if somebody was raping my wife or killing my kids or breaking in my house, I could care less. I'd try to think about something else, but there was only one thing I could think about, and that was that pain and that dreaded just knowing is going to get worse and worse, and poof. Well, when poof came, that was the relief. But pain incapacitates you. Now, which would you rather have, gals? The pain of childbirth or being crucified? I guarantee you I'd rather have a lactose episode than being crucified. If I had the choice, I'd opt out of the crucifixion, thank you. Now consider just for a moment the pain of the crucifixion. You know, the only thing we can really relate to is the physical pain. And even that's enough to just cause you to shudder. To think about spikes driven through the wrists. Now, the Greek word for hand includes the entire wrist area. They didn't put it through the hands because hanging with your weight on the cross, there's nothing to stop that spike from eating or being pulled through your flesh and your tendons. So they had to put it through the spike where the bone, or through the wrist where the bone would stop it. And then being spiked through the ankle bones or the arch of your feet. We would all pass out. I mean, that was before the nail got driven through the first wrist. We would all pass out from the agony of the pain. And then to be plopped down on that cross. And then they had to suspend themselves, what they would do, literally, because they couldn't breathe. If you actually were, somebody were to hang you by your wrists, even if it was against a wall, that pressure collapses your chest. You cannot breathe properly. You can't get a full breath. You can't go, you just can't do it. Everything's compressed. So your breathing is very, very shallow and carbon dioxide builds up in the system. The only thing they could do is push against those spikes in agony to try and give their chest a little relief to catch a breath of air. If the trauma didn't kill them, if the loss of blood didn't kill them, they would asphyxiate from the buildup of carbon dioxide in their lungs. They drown, in essence, from the gas in their system. And then trying to understand bearing the sins of the world. As 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "For our sakes he made him to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." You can't begin to imagine what it was like for Jesus to bear the sins of all mankind. We could talk about the ugliness. We could talk about all the murders. We could talk about all the incest, the rapes, the beatings, all the cruelty of mankind. And that just gives us a small picture. All we can say is that Jesus endured the sin of mankind and sort of leave it at that and try to understand in our own small, weak way. And then to realize that when Jesus, hanging on the cross, he was literally suspended between heaven and earth. He had no connection with man because he was bearing the sins of all mankind. And the Father could not stand to look upon his Son who had now become sin. So Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That intimacy that he had enjoyed from all of eternity, a greater intimacy than any mother and child has ever known, than any husband or wife has ever known, that intimacy on the cross was broken. Jesus was literally all alone with a greater depth of loneliness than you have ever experienced in your life, even if you grew up as an orphan, being shuttled from orphanage to orphanage or foster home to foster home. To think of the pain that Jesus endured, but catch this, in spite of all the pain, Jesus was not incapacitated by it. It doesn't mean the pain wasn't real. It just meant that his focus on evangelism was so intense that even a thief hanging on the cross, a guy that deserved to die, Jesus, looking down through the ages, knew that this guy who deserved to die, if he was given one last chance, would take it. You talk about the intensity of Jesus Christ and his focus on evangelism. Now, you study the life of Jesus, not even talking about Jesus in glory. You really study the life of Jesus. It just causes you to wonder at his character. I mean, what's one more person, more or less? 6 billion people walking the face of the earth today, not counting the billion or two that have gone on before. What's one more person, more or less? You and I can't relate to big numbers. You get one of these gals like Sally Struthers with her perpetual baby face and the big brown eyes, blue eyes, I don't know what color her eyes are. But they'll do one of these poor kids in Africa or South America or somewhere. And they might just scan the kids, but they always zoom in on one little 3-year-old girl. Like in Africa, for lack of food, they have distended belly. But they'll show just a little girl with big brown eyes, a little bit of dirt on her face and tears in her eyes and flies buzzing around her. Because they know you can't relate to big numbers. That doesn't mean anything to you. But focus on just one little girl or one little boy. And your eyes start welling up with tears and you want to do something for them. See, we can't relate to big numbers, only in individuals. But God can. God can. Again, I ask the question, at the risk of being redundant, what was one more person to God, more or less, among all the billions? That's how intense God is when it comes to evangelism. That's how concerned He is about every single person possible making it to heaven. That's how intense Jesus was and is. The question is, how intense are you? How intense am I when it comes to personal evangelism? It's been said before, you probably heard from Larry Gohl, because Larry Gohl said it more than once. And it's absolutely true. If you were the only person that had ever sinned, Jesus would have hung on that cross for you. If He is that concerned about the thief, so concerned that His own pain and agony of the crucifixion didn't incapacitate Him, if He is that concerned about that thief, He's that concerned about you. That's how much He loves you. That's how much He wants you to go to heaven. But there's a second word that commands our attention. It's called reality. Heaven or hell, eternity hangs in the balance. If you come down the hill on the hill on the Sebum Flat side, you can see on the north side the old road. It's about 40 years old now, and it's pretty deteriorated, but took a big round curve to get up that hill on the hill. But there used to be some signs there, and I remember going from Wolf Creek to Helena, riding with my parents or whoever I was riding with at various times. There used to be three signs there. The first sign said, "All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." Another 100 yards down the road, while you're still thinking about that one, "The wages of sin are death." And about another 100 yards down the road, while you're still thinking about the first two, "But the free gift of God is eternal life." Now, even as a little kid, 8, 10, 12 years old, probably about 12 when the interstate went through there finally and that road was no longer used and those signs were gone. But those types of things stuck in my mind. When you think about hell, it's a terrifying thing. It's like Mr. Wilson has mentioned, you can only think about it so long. Really, you can only think about hell so long. It's good to think about it every day, but you can only think about it so long. It's like the terror that I used to have worrying about grizzlies in the middle of the night. You're out there camping and it's dark and there are things that go bump in the night. And for little kids, at least me anyway, grizzly was one of those things. It's like that horror movie, Alfred Hitchcock. Somebody's in the big mansion or the big house out in the boondocks and it's dark and it's a stormy night and there's lightning and all of a sudden the lights go out. They hear the door open. They can hear the footsteps coming up and know it's not her husband. And so she's backing up the stairwell, backing up along the hallway. Finally, she's in the corner. She can hear the guy coming. She can smell him. She can hear his breathing. All of a sudden, the flash of the lightning, and there on the wall, right beside her, the guy's got his hand raised to bring the knife down. You see a movie like that, and they got sort of quiet, a little bit of intense movie music, and you can just feel the drama. Well, it's that type of terror that makes your blood run cold. That's what hell is like. Jesus said it's a place where the worm does not die. Everyone has an eternal body, a resurrected body. It will not be destroyed. Some people get a body that gets to share the glory of Christ for all of eternity. The rest get a body that the worms can eat on it for all of eternity. Think of darkness, alone, away from the presence of God, in eternal darkness. I remember one time I woke up as a little kid, probably about 4 years old. I could tell you a lot of stories from when I was a little kid. I was a wild little kid, but I was left all alone. I wake up in the middle of the night, dark house, all the lights out, everybody's gone. I don't know where my sister went. Don't know where my mother was. can't remember too much. I'm back 5 years old. Maybe I was 4 years old. But I was scared and I was crying. I come out of the house looking for somebody. It's dark in the middle of the night. The only thing that distracted me was, you know, how light diffracts from your tears. There was a street light there, and that just sort of caught my attention, so I sort of forgot about being afraid. But we don't like darkness. I woke up the other morning, and I got to thinking, a lot of times I wake up, and Diane gets up before I do, and she does her devotions, goes to the gym. I get up a little bit later, and it was pretty dark, and I try and stay asleep, and because I don't want to wake up in the middle of the night, because I have a habit of doing that, and I'm awake for a couple hours, and I don't get enough sleep. But so I check for the light. If I do that, then I'll be more awake, and I don't want to be awake. I want to go to sleep. And I think, well, it might be, Diane's gone, so it might be getting pretty late time for me to get up. So, but I waved my hand, you know, in front of my face, see if I could see it. It's like a Lewis and Clark cabin. You can't see your hand. I'm thinking, I know it's not that dark in here. Now, we got two windows on our side in the basement there, and we got them covered up, so it stays dark as long as possible. There's got to be enough light to see my hand. Well, there wasn't at the moment, if I gave my eyes a chance. So I peeked the cover. Yeah, sure enough, there's a little sliver of light there, time to get up. But the idea of darkness, we don't like the idea of darkness, of being alone, absolutely alone forever. But that's what's at stake. Agony like you've never experienced. Agony like you never want to experience. You know, it's been a nice winter day. And it was a nice winter's day 26 years ago. Another place, another time. If you go to Helena, there's three cemeteries in Helena. There's a big Catholic one on the east side of the old French Road. And then there's two on the left side. If you go into one of them, you'll come in at the corner, you go through the stone archway. You go just about straight, just a hair to the right, then take a little left, maybe 100 yards into the cemetery. Start looking at those gravesites. You'll see two of them. One that says, Myrtle I. Vaught, December 12th, 1985. Then beside it to the left, second one says, Robert D. Vaught, February 7th, 1986. Well, Myrtle was my stepmother, and Robert, Bob, was my dad, as you could guess. Almost 21 years ago to the day. Tomorrow by date, but Friday by day. I remember getting the call. 21 years of agony with only an eternity to go. For 21 years, my dad and my stepmother have known only what the rich man cried out to Father Abraham, please send Lazarus. Just allow him to dip his finger and touch my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames. 21 years of agony with only an eternity to go because my dad died outside of Jesus Christ. Now my conscience is clear. My brother spent an hour and a half with him one afternoon. But he was so dull in his old age, it just takes a lot longer, the older they are, for the message to sink in. His reality is an agony, of an eternity of agony. A number of years ago, I had various people that had left the congregation. And in the midst of the turmoil, there was one guy that said he had some prospects, but he didn't want to have them come to the assembly because of the turmoil that existed at that time. Well, I preached a message one time, and I said, hey, no problem. Let them go to hell instead. You know, there's nothing worse you could do than not tell somebody about Jesus Christ. There's nothing worse you can do than to do nothing And you take a look at the life of Jesus Christ, it was filled with controversy from the beginning to the end. You take a look at Peter and Paul and the rest of the apostles, it was controversy from beginning to end. There was always turmoil. Never was a time where there wasn't turmoil except the very first weeks when they found favor in the sight of the people. But from that point on, it was controversy. It's simple. Don't rock the boat. Just let them go to hell instead. The reality is, if you don't tell them, who will? That brings us to the third word that commands our attention. You know what a command is? It's not optional. God's saying this stuff isn't optional. The intensity, the reality, and the responsibility. Yours and mine. And when I read Ezekiel, Ezekiel was the watchman on the tower, and God applied it to sin. He said, if you don't tell these wicked people to turn from their wicked ways, and if the righteous man changes his mind and you don't warn him to get back, he said, they'll die because of their own sin. It's their responsibility. But Ezekiel, if you don't tell them their blood, I'm going to require at your hand. Now, I wasn't worried about Ezekiel. I was worried about Rick. I was worried about me. Ezekiel's long gone, almost 3,000 years ago. Not quite 3,000 years. But you understand the message, don't you? Just like I did, and just like I do, or should. So I was worried about me. There's five distinct ways that God tells us that evangelism is a personal responsibility. First of all, direct command, the Great Commission. Go into all the world and make disciples, immersing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and continuing to teach them all that I've commanded you. You have the direct command. In 1 Peter 3:5, we're told to always be ready to make a defense for anyone who asks you for the hope that lies within you. Colossians chapter 4 says, make the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, as it were, so you may know how to answer every person. Make the most of the opportunity. It's a direct command. The example of the early church in Acts chapter 8, verse 4, says those who had been scattered went about preaching the word everywhere. That was right on the heels of the execution of Stephen. And it says that Saul at that time was breathing out threats and slaughter. So the persecution was now hot and heavy. And Acts 8:4 says everyone was scattered. They had to leave. A lot of them had to flee Jerusalem. But everyone who was scattered went about preaching the word. Their circumstances didn't stop them. They understood their priority. So you have the example of the early church in Acts chapter 11, verses 19 and 20. It talks about the Jews scattering, and they went as far as Antioch of Syria. And it said that some were preaching the word to Jews only, but others went to the Gentiles. And it was in Antioch that they first were known as Christians. Now this is just after, this is Acts chapter 11, just after Peter had evangelized the household of Cornelius. So the impression you clearly get from the scriptures that everyone did it, wherever they went. It took them a while to get over their prejudice against the Gentiles, but once they understood it, they started carrying the message to the Gentiles as well, wherever they went. Thirdly, the principle of imitation. Jesus said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. You know, that's inherent in the idea of discipleship. It isn't just some guy like a master teacher gathering disciples and then that's all there is. No, the disciples become master teachers themselves in due time. They go out and gather more disciples. And those disciples become master teachers. And then they go out and do the same. It's duplication. That's inherent in the very concept of the Great Commission, the principle of imitation. I want you to turn to Luke chapter 9. Very interesting. Luke chapter 9. You remember the guys that said, Lord, I'll follow you, but first let me do this. Three guys. But I want you to notice what Jesus says to one of them. Luke chapter 9, begin verse 57. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, I will follow you wherever you go. Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And he said to another, "Follow me." But he said, "Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father." Now catch this. But he said to him, "Allow the dead to bury their own dead, but as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God." You catch the equation? To follow Jesus means to go everywhere and proclaim the kingdom of God. That's what it means to follow Jesus. The principle of imitation. Paul said, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." 1 Corinthians 11:1. What did Jesus do in his fleshly body? He evangelized. What did Paul do in his fleshly body from beginning to end? He evangelized. In Philippians chapter 1, where Paul's contemplating his death later in life, he says, "I don't know which to do. Whether to go to heaven, I'd rather go to heaven and end it right now." He said, "For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And to remain on is more necessary for your sake and will produce fruitful labor for me." All Paul could think about. He's going to live in the flesh. He is going to be involved in fruitful labor. Philippians 4:9. He told the Philippians, he said, "Whatever you've seen or heard in me, practice what you have seen in me." In Corinthians, Paul told the Corinthians, he said, "I have become all things to all men that I might by all means save some." He knew the majority would say no, but Paul wasn't focused on the no's. He was looking for the yeses. So he would do whatever it take, Jew or Gentile, whatever means or method or creativity his mind could conjure up to carry the message so that someone would respond in a positive way. In Acts chapter 20, I want you to turn there. This is very important. This is where Paul calls the Ephesian elders. And he's on the coast, and he doesn't have time to go inland and visit Ephesus. He's worried that they might be detained there, so he calls, he sends a messenger, and the elders come to him. Acts chapter 20, verses 24 through 27. Acts 20, 24. "But I do not consider my life of any account as dear to myself, so that I may finish my course and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify solemnly of the gospel of grace of God. And now behold, I know that all of you among whom I have went about preaching the kingdom will no longer see my face. Therefore, I testify to you this day that I am innocent of the blood of all men. For I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God." He says, "I'm innocent of the blood of all men." Paul could say that. I'll be honest, I can't. I can't. There were people I was too afraid to talk to, and they died. I hope God won't hold their blood against me. It's the principle of imitation. Fourth is the nature of a plant. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, the church is described as a field. We know the church is described as a bride. We know the church is described as a kingdom. There are other pictures that God gives of the church. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, we're described as a field. But what kind of field is it? We know from the parables of the kingdom in Matthew chapter 13, it's a wheat field. It's not a desert with no plants there except when it rains on rare occasions. No, it's a wheat field. What does wheat do? It grows two ways. It grows upward and it grows outward. The upward is the edification. It's like a hen and her chicks. We got one in the side of our house, one of the few plants that Diane can successfully raise. They live outdoors. They don't live indoors. But you plant a little hen there. A year later, you got some chicks, right? And 2 years later, you get a little bigger patch. See, that's the nature of plants. They grow upward, that's edification. They grow outward, that's evangelism. They sprout seeds, and then the seeds at the right time of year drop, scatter, the birds carry them, dogs carry them, some get trampled on, some of them get ate. But you got a plant here, a few years later, you got a whole field of plants. That's the nature of a plant. We are a kingdom, we are a field full of wheat, and each of us are those wheat stalks. We're supposed to grow upward and we're supposed to grow outward. And then finally, five distinct ways that God tells us that evangelism is a personal responsibility, direct command, example of the early church, the principle of imitation, the nature of a plant, and the requirement of our priesthood. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. We are a royal priesthood. We are a holy nation. We are people for God's own possession, that we may do what? Proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called us out of darkness. A few months ago, we did a series on the requirements or the sacrifices of a spiritual priesthood. The Lord's Supper, giving, praying, singing, and evangelism. Physical priests offered up physical sacrifices. Spiritual priests offered up spiritual sacrifices. In Romans chapter 15, you need to turn there. This will be one of our last scriptures. It's beginning to wind down. Verses 15 and 16. Romans 15, 15. This should be lodged in our minds. It says, but I have written very boldly to you on some points so as to remind you again because of the grace that was given to me from God to be a minister of Christ Jesus to the Gentiles, ministering as a priest the gospel of God so that my offering of the Gentiles may become acceptable, sanctified by the Holy Spirit. Paul understood part of his priesthood was to proclaim the gospel so the Gentiles, figuratively speaking, would be a offering, a sacrifice to God, a pleasing aroma to Him. See, that's one of the sacrifices of a spiritual priesthood. Now, Paul understood the requirement of his priesthood. Do I understand mine? Do you understand yours? Someone in that family camp, they used a little ditty about taking out the garbage, and I don't remember the point that they were making, how it fit in, but I really latched on to that ditty, so I got to speak sometime after them. But evangelism is like taking out the garbage. Everybody knows it needs to be taken out. Anybody could do it in the family, but unless somebody does it, nobody will do it. See, everybody knows we should evangelize. Anybody could do it, but unless somebody does it, nobody will. It's like that poem, He has no hands but our hands, no feet but our feet, no mouth but our mouth. That's His choice. That's the only way He's going to do it. Go back to the Great Commission. Jesus said, go into all the world. And Peter goes, oh, that's not my job. That's James' job. James says, no, not me. How about John? John says, no, what are you doing picking on me? You're always picking on us, Peter. How about your brother? That's Andrew's job to evangelize. Andrew goes, no, that's Thomas's job. You know the doubter? Now, each one of the apostles took it personally. Even though it's stated in plural, every one of them had understood it singularly. It's my job to go out into all the world. Now, you're familiar with Jesus sending out the 12, as recorded in Matthew chapter 10, to go out two by two? You go to Luke chapter 10, it tells us He sent out 70 on another occasion, two by two, to go out and preach the Word. It was their job, it's our job as well. Why evangelize? God says so. Because heaven and hell's at stake. For your mom, your dad, your workers, your fellow workers, your neighbors, if they're outside of Jesus Christ, can you be so callous that you don't care? You just sort of assume that God will let you get by? Another reason is the joy of a new birth. Now, you guys know I'm a little bit weird, but nothing new there. But we got this little deal. in the mail. That was a Christmas present. Just a note. Little hearts on there. I meant to ask Diane. I knew there was something I was supposed to ask Diane, so I'd get these details right. But Valerie wrote a little note. Grandpa and Grandma. I knew as soon as I saw those words what was coming. She said, "We've got a Christmas present for you. Your grandchild is due on December 19th. I cried. I bawled. Don't ask me why. I did. Like I said, I'm weird. I didn't cry when Diane said, "Hey, dear, I'm pregnant." None of those three times. But I cried when I heard that I was going to have a grandchild. And the joy of a new birth. How excited were you, Shanna, when your little boy was born? Pretty painful, wasn't it? How many hours were the labor? 19. I just had an idea that you'd be one of those long ones. You thought you'd never get through it, right? Okay, Justin probably thought you were never going to get through it either, or Jason. But when he came out, did you forget about that pain? Would you be willing to do it again? Are you saying you got one in the hopper? Oh, congratulations. She says, "I haven't got any choice." Are you looking forward to the pain? No. Okay. All right. Of course not. But you're looking forward to that little boy or girl, right? You betcha. The joy of a new birth. That's another reason to evangelize. What do I do? What do I say? Invite people for dinner. You can at least do that. Invite your neighbors. We've invited half the congregation. You guys don't need it for the sake of salvation. But invite your neighbors. Invite your coworkers. Invite people over. Sometime drop those teasers, those baits, like Jay was talking about. I do that in my conversation. Let your conversation be seasoned with salt. What do I say? Anything. It doesn't matter. Seriously, it doesn't matter what you say. I know when I got involved in A.L. Williams, my mentor, he was perfect. He was just fast, old Dean Fraley. He was quick on his feet. He knew what to say. You had an objection, he had a counter to it. But his mentor had what was known as a dry market. He ain't nobody. He was down in Florida, didn't know a single soul. And he got involved in the company. He had what he called a 3-foot rule. He would literally go to the malls. He said, you got a tape measure there. You measure out about 3 foot. Anybody comes in within 3 foot of you, you say, "Excuse me, would you like to make $1,000 a month part-time on the side or save $500,000 a year on your bills?" And he said, most people are supposed to say no. People coming by, some guy saying, "Excuse me, would you?" And getting their kids away from this guy. Some people just look the other way. You know, who's this weird guy? But that was called the 3-foot rule. What if someone says no? Move on to the next person. Don't take it personally. They used to have what they called the great next rule. "I'm not interested." "Great! Next!" That is supposed to be our attitude in evangelism. Sounds like you don't care for people. That's not it. The train is leaving. Get on board. If they don't want to get on board, grab the next guy. Get on board. Great. Next. Forget the no's. Don't take it personally. Most people are supposed to say no. I heard that for about a year and a half, and it finally sunk into me. I always thought I had to have the golden tongue like my original mentor. I had to say the right thing. Sort of like you're tricking people almost, although that wasn't the intent, but just the right words to sort of mesmerize them. No, 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 no. Most people are supposed to say no. You understand that? You talk to people about Christ, you want to go to heaven? No. Most people are supposed to say no. They don't want to go. Great. Next. Find another one. Find another one. Go for the yeses. If you concentrate on the no's will kill you. A good salesman doesn't focus on the no's. A good salesman doesn't close half of his sales. You know that? They don't. If they do a third, they're doing good. They're making lots of money, in fact, if they just do a third. Focus on those yeses. Okay. I've asked one time, this was a dead end, but I asked my boss one night, we were both working there late at night, and I said, do you ever think about eternity? No. But that's something you can try. I was talking to a guy named George Forwarn down at the library, hadn't seen him for a long time, and had a conversation for a bit, and I said, George, how's your spiritual life? Pause. Sometimes you can see the wall go up, the invisible wall. But there's a conversation. What are you going to do? I was talking to another coworker late one night, and I was afraid of what he was going to do. But I said, Buzz, what are you going to do? He's working over to the left, and it's like, huh? I said, what are you going to do when you die? The Bible says it's appointed unto man once to die, and after this comes judgment. Well, he made some excuse. But see, come up with any line you want. I'm serious. It absolutely does not matter what you say. It's like bouncing a ball. You bounce a ball to somebody, what are they going to do? They're going to bounce it back to you, right, Stan? Now, Stan's still young enough, even though he's got a few gray hairs. If I bounce a ball to him, he's still got that little kid in him, he'll bounce it back. In other words, they're going to say something, good, bad, or indifferent. Then you just bounce the ball back to them. You say something in response. You start finding out where they're at. Now listen to me again. It doesn't matter what you say. Seriously. Just bounce the ball to them. And then see how they respond and go from there. Okay. What if they say yes? Oh, I never thought about that. It's like giving the invitation. You know, you guys get up here and preach, and what do you do if somebody actually comes down the aisle? I remember preaching in Wyoming, in Cody, Wyoming, in the summer of 74. This old guy that somebody had been working with, he wasn't that old, I'm getting there. But he's in his 60s. I give the invitation at the end of the paltry message that I delivered, and this guy comes forward, I didn't know what to do. You got to be prepared for that. Okay, so what if they say yes? Well, you got to have a track to run on, and then you got the Bible study booklets. And if you need help, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. Get some help. Get some help. Now, after all is said and done, there's a lot more said than done. After all is said and done, what are you going to do? Now, each of us has the responsibility to evangelize. Now, you and I can put it one of two ways. Am I going to evangelize? That's indefinite. That's a question mark. Maybe yes, maybe no. But it needs to be one of our affirmatives that we write down on that card that you say in the morning, you say at each meal, and you say at night before you go to bed. They say it takes at least 21 days to form a good habit. We got 22 days. It's a leap year, right? 28 days if we all start tomorrow. Instead of saying, am I going to evangelize, turn it into an affirmative. I am evangelistic. I am the type of person that shares the gospel with others. I am a person who tells other people about Jesus Christ. I was just thinking about that. I was going over this message. I've never done that. I've never put it on a card. I've never said it for 21 days. But starting tonight, I am. Not am I? Question mark. I am. How about you?